Hello, this is Pat Barron, your host with Radio Free Market. And today we are honored to have with us on the line from London, England, Detlev Slichter. Detlev, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Thanks so much. Glad to be on your show.
Well, glad to have you. Thank you very much for agreeing to be with us. Detlev is a 19-year veteran of the financial community in London. He's worked with J.P. Morgan, Merrill Lynch, Western Asset Management. And then in 2009, he sort of left that to write what I consider one of the most important books that I have read in the last few years, and it's called Paper Money Collapse, and the subtitle is The Folly of Elastic Money in the Coming Monetary Breakdown. This is a book, I believe, that if anyone feels that they have the time and the inclination to read one book about economics and what's going on in the world financially right now, this is the book to read. I was overwhelmed with it. In fact, I got a copy. After I read my copy, I bought a copy for Radio Free Market's founder, Michael McKay, and gave it to him for Christmas, and he agreed that it's just a magisterial book. So Detlev, I'm very glad to have you, and we'll just start right out. There's a lot in this book, but I would like to concentrate our interview on Chapter 9. So we're well into the book, and the Chapter 9 is titled The Intellectual Superstructure of the Present System. And Detlev, I wonder if you could explain what you mean by intellectual superstructure and what the current mainstream view ignores.
Yes, what I mean by that is that you see if a crisis occurs, like the present financial crisis, a debate occurs, a debate takes place, and every debate occurs on the basis of widely accepted theories or widely accepted views about the market and how economics work and how crises come about. And we see the same in this situation here, where I think the current debate is very much shaped by macroeconomics, by the specific macroeconomics that has dominated economic science and discussion over the last 70 years. It's mainly Keynesianism, it's also monetarism, and a few other macroeconomic schools. And it's not so important here for me what these schools of thought say in particular, but they have a certain worldview, a certain way of looking at economic phenomena. And what they do is they're always looking at them in terms of macro data. And you can see this right now in the discussion about the crisis. We talk about GDP, about the inflation rate, so all these national account statistics, and people often perceive this crisis as a lack of aggregate demand. And that's why, there's instantly sort of this idea that the government has to do something about this and generate extra aggregate demand by stimulating the economy with easy money or deficit spending. But the ease with which everybody accepts these ideas and recipes is simply the result of the specific way of people look at these phenomena. And what people completely ignore, what is completely not part of this discussion, is all the things that happen and occur underneath these macro variables that we always read about in the paper and that the discussion focuses on. And these are things like resource allocation, relative prices. The economy is not just about creating GDP and aggregate demand. The economy is about allocating scarce resources, shifting resources from one area to another. And a crisis occurs really if this process, the market process, is disrupted. But all these things about how resources get misallocated, how capital gets misallocated, this is completely ignored in the current debate. And it's very interesting for me that I think historically, more than 70 or 80 years ago, I think most economists would have looked at these phenomena differently and therefore would have been open to different and better explanation for what has happened.
Yes, and I would like to give an illustration of that, which I think we might think it's humorous, but it turns out it really isn't very humorous for the people involved. And that was in the fortunately now his no longer with us Soviet Union. They had economic plans. They had 1 5-year plan after another, and they would dictate what would be produced. And our own Central Intelligence Agency was greatly inflating the gross national product of the Soviet Union because they were looking at raw numbers, which may have been correct. And here's an example of they would produce, the plan would say that so many tons of nails would be produced. And they would probably produce those or even exceed that. But what would happen is there was a shortage of small nails. No one could find a small nail to repair their roof because one way to meet the plan was to produce very, very large nails. And so our own CIA would say that the Soviet Union had a large GDP, but it wasn't meeting the needs of the people. Would you say that that's a fair statement?
Absolutely right. And I think it's interesting. I mentioned Keynesianism before. When Keynes, you know, proposed his theories in the 1930s, you know, this was not a time when sort of the free market system and capitalism were in high esteem. I mean, quite the contrary. And there is this story that when Keynes wrote the foreword for the German edition of the General Theory, which was published in 1936 in Germany, he even said in the foreword that what he's proposing in terms of policy is more easily adaptable to a totalitarian society rather than a free market economy. And I think the way that economics has evolved, and I'm not here saying that today Keynesians or monetarists or, you know, other, you know, macroeconomists are, you know, socialists, or, you know, would perceive themselves to be central planners, but looking at the economy from the top down in terms of these macro variables, and assuming that we can, via certain means, you know, manipulate these macro variables, we can create a better economy. That is a way of thinking that is very much sort of the macroeconomic model thinking that developed over the last 60, 70 years. Now, if you look at the present crisis, we have to ask ourselves, how did this come about? And if we look at things like the housing bubble and the distortions in the housing market, you know, these are not GDP or macro phenomena in the sense that, you know, sort of a macroeconomist would first and foremost look at them. There are misallocations of resources. And we have to ask ourselves, how could these come about? And I think in my book I argue that such extensive, protracted misallocations of capital can only have one origin. One way to explain their existence, and this is the persistent misallocation of capital through financial markets by artificially lowering interest rates, by expanding the money supply, and I show in my book how this must systematically, you know, distort an economy, lead to booms that will ultimately turn into busts, which is the traditional, you know, Austrian business cycle theory.
Yes, and you mentioned in our little talk just here in the past few minutes that the macroeconomists are determined to stimulate the economy. And in Chapter 9, you have a section about the stimulus myth and why this idea of stimulating an economy is really not an appropriate way to look at economics. Would you care to expand on that a little?
Yeah, I mean, the way this is being talked about in the public or in the newspapers always assumes that, you know, GDP is a good thing. So if you have higher GDP, it's great. And the idea is always we all benefit from a higher GDP. Now, if we stimulate the economy by printing money, this may, you know, or may not lead to higher inflation. But if it does, people would say, well, that's not our dominant problem right now. A little bit of higher inflation is not a problem. And that's kind of a cost of that strategy. So the assumption always is we all benefit from higher GDP, and you know, we all suffer, you know, from inflation. We need to balance the two. And this is, again, one of these kind of macro views, you know, 40,000 feet above the economy, that completely ignores what goes on the ground level. Because what you can show, and what I argue in my book, is, you know, any kind of stimulus creates winners and losers. You know, if you lower interest rates artificially, if you pump additional money into the economy, that money doesn't reach everybody in the economy at the same time. Every monetary injection, every expansion of monetary policy will lead to the money, you know, reaching some people sooner than others. And you can show that always. There is no exception to this. It always creates the winners and losers. The earliest recipients of new money benefit at the expense of later recipients of the money. And you can show this also with other means of sort of stimulating the economy. You may generate these short-term statistical effects. You may, you know, massage the GDP numbers a little bit higher. But that doesn't mean that everybody in the economy has benefited from your interventions. In particular, you have to consider that we participate in the economy not because we want to have a higher GDP. I mean, nobody participates in the market economy because our goal is to create higher aggregate demand. We have specific plans. You know, we want to generate an income to buy a house or to go on holiday or pay the education of our children or whatever our plans are. The market economy allows us to, you know, be more productive as we cooperate with others on markets. That's a very delicate process, and the crisis is a sign that that process is somehow interrupted. But by just going in and forcing additional economic activity by artificially lowering interest rates or by, you know, doing deficit spending, you again interfere in the economy, again disrupt the coordinating process. And yes, some people may in the short term benefit from your measures, but others may have no benefit of this at all. So I think this kind of your macro perspective gives us a completely distorted view of what goes on in the economy, and I think this leads to bad policy.
Well, another macro policy that the mainstream economists do not like is they don't like savings. They want consumption, and I wonder if you could speak just briefly about what you call the myth of the savings glut and the myth of underconsumption.
Well, the first thing we have to say is that, you know, economies don't get richer by consumption; they get richer by saving and production. We get more. Our standard of living rises by us becoming more productive. And how can we become more productive? Well, there is really only one way in which we can do this, which is by increasing the amount of available capital per worker. You know, there's technical innovation, and then is a higher capital intensity. Our societies are richer than those in, you know, poor countries because we have a bigger and more elaborate capital stock that we have accumulated over the years. That makes us more productive for every hour worked. So you need the capital, and the only way you can build that capital is by not consuming all your income, putting some aside, you know, saving it, and creating a true capital stock. And as I show in my book, is if you print money and then inject money into the economy, you can create an illusion of savings for a while, because the market for a while cannot really distinguish if that is true savings and a lasting basis for capital for building a capital stock, or if this is just a short-term money injection, you know, just printed money that will not sustain, you know, ongoing savings and resource allocation into investment. Now, having said that, so the first thing I'd say is savings is absolutely essential for a growing economy. It's completely a misconception to think that we should stimulate consumption. Now, I think the savings glut theory came up in the run-up to this financial crisis, because, as we all know, for a long time it was clear that things in some economies, in particular in the U.S. economy, looked very strange because we had very low interest rates and, obviously this huge investment boom, in particular in the housing market. So for a while, the Fed was asking itself whether maybe they were too easy, whether their policy was too accommodative, which I think with hindsight we can all say it was. But one of their excuses was basically this idea that, oh, this could all be Asian savings. So it's not like, you know, we are spending too much and we are printing too much money, which allows us to overinvest and distort our capital structure. The idea was, no, this is all, you know, savings that comes up from Asia and find its way over to the United States. Now, I go through this argument in detail in the book, and it's maybe difficult to give a short summary here, but I think what you can show is, well, if indeed there is true savings in other markets, whether it's in Asia or even, you know, true savings in the United States, you know, true savings are never the problem. You know, true savings is if I as a consumer don't spend my entire income, I set resources aside that I could consume but decide not to consume and make these resources available via the capital markets for entrepreneurs to invest. Now, whether I do this in my home country or you do this in the United States or someone in Asia does it and allocates their money to U.S. corporations, it doesn't really matter. You know, if it's true savings, this should not cause a problem. The idea that, you know, there are excess savings is simply nonsense, because if people save, interest rates drop, the savings become available for corporations and entrepreneurs, and they will use it to build a productive capital stock. And what I think indeed happened in the run-up to this financial crisis is that very easy or fairly easy monetary policy in the United States was matched by easy monetary policy in China. So the Chinese linked their monetary policy to that in the U.S., and made sure that they kept pace with whatever monetary expansion occurred in the U.S. market. Now, in the U.S., easy money was channeled via the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and the housing policy into the housing market and consumption. In China, easy money was channeled into the productive capacity and producing cheap goods, mainly for the U.S. market. Now, this allowed for a long time the U.S. consumer to not lose international purchasing power. If your government prints a lot of money, well, you should, all else being equal, you know, realize this fairly quickly by not being able to buy as much overseas. But that did not quite happen, because China matched the easy monetary policy from the U.S., invested heavily in productive capacity. So in terms at least of Chinese goods, you know, the Americans did not lose purchasing power. And for a long time it seemed that, you know, this easy monetary policy could go on, you know, even longer without leading to, you know, measurable inflation. But what I also argue in my book is, you know, this kind of easy monetary policy in the U.S., but also in China, must lead to capital misallocations. I come back to the first point, you know, all these things distort the relative prices in the economy that must distort capital allocation, and things get out of line between investment and saving. That has hit the U.S. economy, and I think it is beginning to hit the Chinese economy as well, and I think this will continue to cause problems.
Well, thank you very much, Dale. This is very, very interesting, and I just wish that we had longer to talk about this, so perhaps in the future you'd care to come back and we could review another section of your book. But I think we're going to have to bring this interview, just in the sake of brevity, to an end. But I want to thank you again for coming on to our show, and remind everyone that Detlev Schlichter is the author of a recent book called Paper Money Collapse, and then the subtitle is The Folly of Elastic Money and the Coming Monetary Breakdown, and it's available on Amazon.com and I'm sure on other websites. So again, Detlev, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Thank you, Patrick. My pleasure.
And we will pick this up again at a future date. This is Pat Barron interviewing Detlev Schlichter from London, England, and this is Radio Free Market. Thanks for being with us.